Think about your morning so far. I mean, you probably bought a coffee, maybe you checked your bank balance, swiped a credit card, or, glanced at your retirement account.
Right, yeah. You're interacting with money every single day.
Exactly. Every single day. But do you actually know how the operating system of American capitalism really works? Like the actual plumbing underneath the drywall, so to speak.
Most people don't even think about it. We just interact with the user interface, right? The banking app on our phones or the checkout terminal at the grocery store.
Yeah, we just tap our phones and move on.
Exactly. But the actual machinery driving where that capital goes, how it's created out of thin air, and who holds the levers of power, that is largely invisible to the public.
And that is exactly what we are decoding today. We're looking at a massive, and I mean massive, comprehensive report published on June 14th, 2026.
It's a big one.
Oh, yeah. It's titled The U.S. Financial System, and it's jointly authored by the American newspaper and American TV. It is essentially an architectural blueprint of the financial world.
Which is a great way to think about it.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive today is to figure out how this huge machine functions, who decides where the money flows,
Yeah.
and why this system is simultaneously this incredible engine for global wealth
Oh.
and also inherently prone to sudden, terrifying crises.
Yeah, it's quite the paradox.
It really is. And notice how the backdrop behind us has shifted to this sprawling, illuminated blueprint of a cityscape. That is the perfect visual for what we are doing today. Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even begin to look at a system with this many moving parts?
Well, we have to start by looking at the literal architecture. I mean, before we can understand how the financial system breaks or even how it grows, we have to understand the physical mechanics of how it is built.
Makes sense. Start from the ground up.
Right. And instead of looking at it as just, a list of banks, it really helps to conceptualize the entire US financial system as a massive high-performance engine. It basically has three distinct components.
Okay, what's the first one?
So the first component is the fuel and ignition system. This is the public monetary and fiscal core. It's made up of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department.
Okay, so the government, basically.
Yeah, exactly. The Fed supplies central bank money, while the Treasury issues the safe collateral that the entire global system literally relies on to function.
So it's the government bedrock. They provide the spark and the gas.
That captures the function really well, yeah. Then we move to the second component, which is like the engine block and the pistons. This is the plumbing.
The plumbing. Okay, who is in the plumbing?
Here is where we find the commercial banks, the broker-dealers, the clearing houses. Their mechanical job is to just move money around, process trillions of daily transactions and settle risk.
Moving the fuel through the engine.
Exactly. And then finally, we have the transmission and the wheels. This is the third component, capital allocation and risk ownership.
Okay, so who are the wheels?
This is where you find asset managers, private equity, venture capital, hedge funds, pension funds, and even just regular households. They are the ones taking the energy generated by the engine and deciding which direction the vehicle actually drives. They put the risk-bearing capital to work.
Wait, let me make sure I'm following here. The commercial banks are just the engine block. They aren't the ones actually driving the direction of the economy.
Well, what's fascinating here is that this specific structure is what makes the United States incredibly unique. I mean, if you look at many other global economies, Europe or Japan, for instance, they are fundamentally bank-centered.
Meaning the banks do everything.
Pretty much. In those places, banks dominate credit creation, they fund the corporations, they hold the risk. But the US system is market-centered. Securities markets play a vastly larger role here than traditional banking. That is its actual superpower.
Oh, I see. So if the US economy is a smartphone, the traditional commercial banks are just the basic pre-installed apps. They are necessary to make the phone run, sure. But the capital markets, like the private equity, the bond markets, the venture capital, that's the actual app store where all the insane growth, customization, and innovation happens.
That works as a framework, definitely. But to take your app store analogy a step further, imagine if half those apps in the store were operating with massive amounts of leverage and driving trillions of dollars in unregulated value.
Oh, wow. So it's a very high-stakes app store.
Exactly. The app store is where the sheer scale of the system becomes apparent. I mean, to give you some context on the size markers from the June 2026 report, we are looking at 45 $1 trillion sitting in U.S. registered investment companies alone.
$45 trillion. That's insane.
Yeah, and we are looking at $39.2 trillion in total public debt. Meanwhile, household mortgage balances are sitting at $13.2 trillion. The scale is just staggering.
Those numbers are almost too big to comprehend. Trillions of dollars flowing through this engine every single day. But if the commercial banks are just the pre-installed apps, what are they actually doing?
Well, they are the ones basically creating the money.
Wait. How does the money get into the hands of a consumer in the first place? Because I think the default assumption for you and me is that the government just prints all the cash at a mint somewhere and hands it to the banks.
Yeah, and that is probably the single biggest misconception we can clear up today. The vast majority of the money you and I use is not printed by the government.
Really? Then where does it come from?
It is bank money. It is created through what the report calls the bank credit money creation loop.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that. How does a regular bank just create money?
Well, when a commercial bank makes a loan, it doesn't take pre-existing money out of a vault or someone else's savings account to give to you.
Wait, they don't?
No. Instead, it performs a synchronized accounting entry. It records an asset on its balance sheet, the loan itself, which you have to pay back with interest. And at the exact same millisecond, it creates a liability.
Which is what?
A brand new deposit in your checking account. That deposit is new purchasing power that literally did not exist a moment before. It is bank money, spoken into existence entirely through the act of lending.
Wait, hold on. When I get a mortgage to buy a house, the bank isn't going into a back room and gathering up the collected savings of my neighbors. They are literally typing that deposit into existence on a ledger just because I signed a piece of paper.
Yep. The physical reality is just keystrokes on a database. The new bank lending creates a matching deposit. Now, obviously, banks are constrained by their own capital reserves, liquidity rules, funding costs, and borrower demand.
Right, so they can't just do it infinitely.
Exactly, they can't do this infinitely. But the fundamental mechanism is ledger creation. However, we do have to contrast this private bank money with central bank money, which operates on a completely different level.
Okay, the Federal Reserve. How is their money different from the money the banks type into my checking account?
So the Fed creates what are called reserves. Now, you and I don't use reserves to buy groceries. Reserves are settlement balances used exclusively in the banking system.
Oh, so it's bank-to-bank money.
Right. Banks use these reserves to settle millions of daily payments with one another and with the Federal Reserve.
Got it. The report actually mentions the Fed operating in an abundant reserves framework. What does that actually mean for the plumbing?
Well, before the 2008 financial crisis, the Fed kept reserves artificially scarce. Banks had to constantly lend reserves to each other overnight just to meet regulatory requirements.
Like scrambling for chairs in a game of musical chairs?
That's exactly what it was like. But today, the Fed intentionally floods the plumbing with reserves. As of June 2026, the Fed's balance sheet had about $6.7 trillion in assets.
$6.7 trillion just sloshing around in the plumbing.
Exactly. Because reserves are so abundant now, banks don't need to scramble for them anymore. So to control interest rates in this flooded system, the Fed uses administered rates.
How does that work?
They basically say to the banks, look, we will pay you a set interest rate just to leave your cash parked safely with us. That rate acts as a floor for all other interest rates in the economy.
Okay, I think I'm getting this. The banks create the money we spend on Main Street, and the Fed creates the reserves the banks use to settle up with each other on Wall Street.
You nailed it.
But earlier, you made a distinction between creating money and allocating capital. If banks are busy typing money into existence, what are the capital markets doing?
Right. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, banks create money via deposits, but markets allocate capital via securities.
Give me an example of that.
Think about a rapidly growing tech startup. A traditional bank isn't going to give a massive loan to a company with no physical collateral, no hard assets, and negative cash flow, right? Especially if it's just an idea for an artificial intelligence app.
Yeah, a bank would laugh them out of the building.
Exactly. But venture capital will fund it. Public equity markets will. Capital markets can fund intangible growth, network effects, and long-duration bets because equity doesn't require a strict contractual monthly repayment the way a bank loan does.
Right, because if you buy a stock, you're taking a risk.
Yeah.
There's no guaranteed monthly check.
Exactly. Markets create a ladder of financing from seed capital all the way up to a public stock offering.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. We've got private banks typing money into existence, and we've got venture capitalists throwing billions at startups, creating massive valuations out of basically just ideas.
Right.
So what keeps this entire system from just floating away into a speculative fantasy? Like, what is anchoring this entire structure to reality?
That is the million-dollar question. The gravitational center for the entire global financial universe is the U.S. Treasury market. As of May 2026, there were about $30.9 trillion in Treasury securities outstanding.
Almost $31 trillion in government debt.
Yes, but the financial architecture doesn't just view it as government borrowing. Treasuries are the benchmark risk-free curve. They are the ultimate safe collateral for the global financial system.
Meaning everyone trusts them.
Exactly. They are the reference rate used to price your mortgage, corporate bonds, and equities. Crucially, they are the collateral used in repo markets.
I hear that term constantly in financial news. Repo markets. Let's break that down. What actually is a repo market?
Repo stands for repurchase agreement. Honestly, think of it as a massive high-end overnight pawn shop for billionaires and institutions.
A billionaire pawn shop. I like that.
Yeah. So if a hedge fund needs $500 million in cash until tomorrow morning, they hand over $500 million in U.S. treasuries to a lender as collateral. They get the cash, and they agree to buy the treasuries back the next day for a tiny bit more money.
So they just pawn the treasuries overnight.
Right. This overnight lending network keeps Wall Street functioning, and it runs almost entirely on the perceived absolute safety of U.S. treasuries.
So if I'm picturing this right, the treasury market is like the foundational bedrock of a massive skyscraper.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, like even if you're building the riskiest, most speculative tech startup penthouse at the very top of the building, the entire structural integrity of your building relies on that treasury market bedrock at the bottom. If the bedrock shakes, the penthouse falls.
That physical analogy is highly accurate, and it actually ties directly into the dominance of the U.S. dollar.
Because everyone needs dollars to buy the treasuries.
Exactly. Dollar dominance isn't just because the U.S. has a large consumer economy. It rests on a specific stack of advantages: deep, highly liquid treasury markets, a credible legal infrastructure, massive payment networks, and military reach.
So it's a whole package.
Right. Because so many global commodities, foreign reserves, and derivatives are priced in dollars, there is a constant, insatiable global demand for safe dollar assets.
Which gives the U.S. lower funding costs and incredible geopolitical leverage.
It does. But it introduces a structural vulnerability. This is what we call the paradox of abundance. The system relies heavily on broker-dealers, the intermediaries, the middlemen, to act as massive warehouses.
Warehouses for the debt?
Yes. They have to use their own balance sheet capacity to absorb, hold, and trade this massive ocean of treasury debt. If the market gets too volatile or heavy government debt issuance overwhelms the dealers, the warehouse is full.
And what happens when the warehouse is full?
They stop buying. The plumbing gets clogged. The system can violently freeze up even if the commercial banks are perfectly healthy. The bedrock literally shakes.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth for a second. We're talking about $30 trillion, global reserve currencies, and dealer balance sheets. How does this macroeconomic plumbing affect the person listening right now?
Well, it dictates their entire economic reality because the American household balance sheet is highly financialized.
Meaning our wealth is tied up in the markets.
Right. Wealth in the U.S. isn't generally built just by saving cash from a paycheck under a mattress. It is built through appreciating assets, you know, home equity, stocks, retirement accounts, pensions. The financial system is a wealth compounding engine.
And the Federal Reserve basically controls the thermostat for that engine.
They do. And they're driven by their dual mandate, maximum employment and stable prices. To achieve this, they adjust the federal funds rate, which in June 2026 was sitting at a target range of 3.50% to 3.75%.
And tweaking that rate ripples through everything, right?
Exactly. When they change that rate, it sends a mechanical shockwave through the entire system. It changes the cost of borrowing for banks, which immediately changes mortgage affordability for consumers, which subsequently changes how investors value stocks.
So what does this all mean? Let's say the economy takes a hit and the Fed steps in to rescue things by aggressively lowering interest rates. That makes borrowing cheaper, which pumps up the value of stocks and houses, right?
The mechanical reality of monetary easing is exactly that. It supports employment by encouraging businesses to borrow and hire, preventing total economic collapse, but it undeniably inflates asset prices in the process.
I want to push back on this a little bit because it sounds like the very tools we use to rescue the economy from disaster are fundamentally designed to widen the wealth gap.
Well, let's look at the mechanics.
Right, because if you already own a house and an investment portfolio, cheap money makes your net worth skyrocket.
Right.
But if you're a renter trying to save up a down payment, suddenly those assets are completely out of reach. Is this massive wealth transfer a bug in the operating system, or is it a feature?
The report explicitly outlines this dynamic. It doesn't actually classify it through a moral lens of a bug or a feature, but simply as a mechanical reality called the inequality channel.
The inequality channel.
Yeah. When liquidity is abundant and rates are low, the mathematical discount rate on future earnings drops, meaning asset prices simply must rise. The data from the Federal Reserve's distributional financial accounts confirms this outcome.
So it's just math.
It is. The system compounds wealth most aggressively for those who already own financial and housing assets. Monetary policy is just a blunt instrument. It is essentially impossible to rescue the labor market with low rates without simultaneously supercharging asset valuations.
So the stratification we're seeing is a direct mathematical consequence of how the financial architecture is physically built.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have a system that relies entirely on leverage, asset inflation, and frankly, human confidence. And because of that, it periodically breaks. But the report outlines how these crises actually force this system to evolve.
They definitely do. Crises are the catalyst for evolution.
Right. And if 2023 proved that banking panics now happen at the speed of light, we need to understand how we got there.
Mm-hmm.
Compare the 2008 financial crisis to the 2023 banking collapses for me.
The nature of the crises completely mutated. 2008 was a failure of credit quality and trust. The system had generated highly opaque, complex mortgage-backed securities with terrible underwriting.
The famous subprime mortgages.
Right. And when housing prices fell, the assets were essentially toxic. No one knew which banks held the toxic risk, so wholesale funding markets simply froze.
It was a crisis of bad assets. Right. The mortgages were junk. And nobody trusted anybody.
Exactly. So the regulatory response to that was to force banks to hold much more capital, undergo rigorous stress tests, and improve their liquidity buffers. They basically built a fortress around bank credit.
Which brings us to the spring of 2023.
Yes. Fast forward to 2023 and the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic. This was entirely different.
I remember this vividly. SVB didn't have a bunch of junk subprime loans, did they?
They didn't. SVB was a modern 21st century bank run. The problem wasn't bad credit. It was duration risk.
Wait, I'm confused here. I thought U.S. government bonds were literally the safest investment on earth.
Yeah.
How does holding safe government bonds trigger a historic bank collapse?
This raises a really important question about bond math. SVB had taken in a massive flood of deposits during the post-COVID zero-rate era. They took that cash and invested it in a very safe long-term government bonds.
Which sounds totally fine. You get your money back in 10 years. Guaranteed.
Right. But when the Fed rapidly raised interest rates in 2022 to fight inflation, newer bonds started paying much higher interest. That means the market value of SVB's older, low-yielding bonds absolutely plummeted.
Oh, I see.
That is duration risk. It's when rising rates destroy the present-day resale value of long-term assets.
So the bedrock shook. They held safe assets, but they were underwater on paper.
Exactly. But what made SVB uniquely lethal wasn't just the math, it was the depositors. Its deposit base was highly concentrated with uninsured tech companies, and they were all intimately connected through venture capital networks.
Right, everyone knew everyone.
Yeah. When rumors started circulating, it wasn't people lining up around the block in the rain like in the 1930s. It was founders in private WhatsApp groups, frantically wiring tens of millions of dollars from their iPhones while waiting in line for coffee.
A run on the bank from a smartphone.
Exactly. They coordinated digitally and withdrew billions of dollars at unprecedented speed. It was duration risk weaponized by a digital run at the speed of light.
So 2008 was about bad assets and opacity. 2023 was about interest rates and the sheer velocity of digital panic. If panic happens that fast now, it makes sense that the financial world is looking for new places to hide the risk.
They always do.
Is that why we're seeing this massive migration into private credit in 2025 and 2026?
That is the direct cause and effect. Because regulators made traditional commercial banks operate like highly restricted utilities after 2008, a massive amount of corporate lending simply migrated out of the light and into non-bank entities.
Which is what we call private credit.
Right. It's essentially the new shadow banking frontier.
Explain the difference for me. What makes a private credit loan different from a normal bank loan?
Well, historically, if a huge corporation wanted $1 billion, they would get a syndicated bank loan, a lead bank would organize it, and dozens of large banks would split the risk.
Right, highly regulated.
Exactly. But today, a single massive private credit fund backed by insurance money or university endowments can just write that billion-dollar check themselves. Companies prefer it because of speed and customization.
So they just bypass the banks entirely.
Yep. If a private equity sponsor needs rapid financing for a corporate buyout, a private credit fund can move much faster than a syndicate of heavily regulated banks.
But if all this risk is moving out of the regulated banks and into the shadows, doesn't that make the system a lot more dangerous?
It fundamentally changes the nature of the risk. Private credit is opaque by design. The valuations are periodic, meaning these massive loans aren't priced daily by a public market.
Which means we don't know what they're actually worth on any given Tuesday.
Right. If we hit a severe economic downturn, regulators don't know exactly how much leverage is buried inside those private funds or if there will be a severe liquidity mismatch when investors inevitably panic and try to pull their money out all at once.
So the risk didn't disappear, it just changed its address.
Exactly.
What about crypto? I mean, we saw it crash, we saw it boom. Has it finally become part of the actual plumbing?
It is aggressively attempting to. The 2026 view from the report is that crypto is shifting away from purely speculative, volatile tokens and trying to embed itself as actual financial infrastructure.
Okay, so less about dog coins and more about structure.
Right. We are seeing a major push toward stablecoins and the tokenization of assets, specifically treasuries.
The report mentions moving claims onto programmable blockchain rails. What does that actually mean practically?
It means instead of waiting 2 days for a stock trade or a bond purchase to settle through multiple intermediaries and clearinghouses, a smart contract on a blockchain automatically verifies the funds and transfers the asset instantly, 24/7.
Wow, instant settlement.
Yeah. The strategic question regulators are wrestling with right now is whether these digital assets will be fully integrated into the regulated plumbing or if they'll remain a parallel, potentially destabilizing shadow system.
That makes sense. And then there is the absolute elephant in the room, artificial intelligence.
Oh, yes.
The report explicitly notes AI is moving from just being a back office summarization tool to being an active, autonomous decision engine for trading, underwriting, and risk modeling. And the Federal Reserve has officially flagged it as a financial stability risk frontier. Why are they so worried?
Well, the opportunity with AI is unprecedented precision and scale. But the risks are incredibly complex. First, there is model opacity. We don't always know why the AI made the decision it made.
The black box problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then there are cybersecurity vulnerabilities, and there is what regulators call hallucinated analysis, where the AI confidently generates a fundamentally flawed risk model.
That sounds dangerous.
It is. But the single most systemic risk is crowded behavior and automation without accountability.
Let me pose a scenario to you, because this is what keeps me up at night. If every massive asset manager and hedge fund starts using the exact same highly optimized AI models trained on the exact same historical market data.
Right, which they probably will.
Yeah. And suddenly, those models all perceive the exact same microscopic risk in the market and decide to exit a trade at the exact same millisecond. Aren't we just automating the next bank run at the speed of light?
The data actually points to that being a very real, very terrifying possibility. AI fundamentally changes the speed of finance. I mean, the 2023 SVB run was fast because humans used Twitter and mobile apps.
Right, human speed.
But an AI-driven flash crash or an automated algorithmic run would happen entirely without human intervention. It would execute at a scale and speed we have not even stress-tested yet. When automation lacks human friction, it creates extreme vulnerability to crowded trades.
That is equal parts fascinating and totally terrifying. We've covered a staggering amount of ground today, from the engine of the financial architecture to the ledger magic of bank deposit creation, the absolute gravity of the treasury market, the mechanics of wealth inequality, the evolution of crises, and the shadow migration of risk.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. How do we synthesize all of this? What is the final verdict on the U.S. financial system?
The grand synthesis is that the U.S. financial system is not inherently a moral force. It is simply a high-powered machine.
A machine that just does what it's built to do.
Exactly. It is uniquely capable of funding startups, scaling public companies, and financing the government at a velocity literally no other nation can match. It grows economies incredibly fast because it structurally encourages leverage, securitization, and rapid innovation.
But the downside of strapping yourself to a high-powered machine is that when it crashes, the wreckage is catastrophic.
Precisely. It clashes harder because of those exact same mechanisms. Leverage and confidence are a double-edged sword. I mean, a highly conservative, heavily restricted, bank-only system might be significantly safer, but it would be far less dynamic.
So it's a choice we've made.
Yes. The U.S. system is dynamic, deeply liquid, and crisis-prone by design. That is the core, inescapable trade-off.
So the next time you swipe a credit card, or check your 401k balance, or read a headline about the Federal Reserve tweaking interest rates, you aren't just observing isolated events. You are interacting with this massive, layered, highly sensitive architectural blueprint. You are standing inside the high-powered machine.
Well said.
And as we wrap up this deep dive into the blueprint, we want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've learned today that the entire banking system, from the digital ledger of your local checking account to the $30 trillion global treasury market, ultimately rests on one incredibly fragile human emotion, confidence. But as artificial intelligence increasingly takes over the autonomous decision-making of capital allocation, we have to wonder, what happens to the financial system when confidence is no longer a human psychological state, but a cold, algorithmic calculation? If the machines lose confidence in us, who bails out the system?